I'll promise to speak to you, but I won't promise to speak on the subject. I think the last time I have been in, I suspect, Dallas, I gave a speech on prostitution. And I divided it into inquiring. In the first place, why is there prostitution? In the second place, why is it, does it exist at a particular rate, at a particular period? Thirdly, why do some people become prostitutes? And fourthly, who uses it and why? I propose to use that same scheme for the ensuing discussion of bureaucracy. Let me start by pointing out that bureaucracy has sufficient virtues to make sure that it exists and will continue to exist. These, very briefly, are the virtues of regularity, predictability, a fixed boundary between approved, prescribed, and disapproved or condemned behavior, rationality, distribution of authority for specific tasks. I'd go so far as to say that without bureaucracy, it would be impossible to apply legal rules, to perform the administrative and military tasks that any state has to perform. As a matter of fact, empires and churches and armies and business firms have always recognized no less. Therefore, you have in all of these institutions bureaucracies characterized by somewhat different characteristics, but nonetheless bureaucracies. And these bureaucracies have always been reborn after millenarian sects tried to overthrow the bureaucratized churches, or after revolutionary impetus overthrew a particular government or form of government. So I would say that the existence of bureaucracy is something that is both necessary and unavoidable. And we'll turn to the next question, namely, why does it exist at a particular rate? Why does it have a particular scope? Why does it have particular powers at any given time? And why, in particular here, it seems to me that the interesting thing is not so much to look at the general rate at which bureaucracy occurs, but rather at the rates and powers that characterize bureaucracy in different activities and sponsored by different authorities. Why, for instance, do we now live in a time where the governmental bureaucracy has greatly increased and has a tendency to further expand at the expense of other bureaucracies of a non-governmental sort? And what can we do about it? Well, the answer here is fairly simple. We can try to restrict government bureaucracy to some extent by limiting the scope of the government. And that, of course, was the intention of the framers of our constitutions, which would make non-governmental agencies perform more or less bureaucratically a number of the tasks that now are performed by governmental agencies. A second point is that citizens, of course, retain at this point the power to change the direction of the bureaucracy as a matter of form. In practice, that has become pretty much impossible. So what we may still be able to do is to restrict the power of governmental bureaucracies, the attempt to give it specific directions by means of exercising the political power of the legislative power of the people is, I wouldn't say altogether lost, but for the time being, it has not been shown to be very effective. The reason that it has not been very effective is that bureaucracies, headed by the judiciary, has simply been able to ward off any changes or restrictions that Congress or the executive have tried to impose on it. When you look, for instance, at the death penalty, to give a very simple indication, you look at the Constitution, a commendable document, It speaks of capital crimes in the Fifth Amendment, and also in the Fifth Amendment says that no one shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, which implies, as clearly as it can be, that there is a due process of law by means of which people can be deprived of life, liberty, or property, which means that the Constitution clearly sanctions capital punishment. And I think it's ridiculous to believe that the Fifth Amendment could have been repealed by the Eighth Amendment, which opposes cruel and unusual punishment. That Eighth Amendment was adopted at the same time as the Fifth Amendment, and hardly to repeal it. So the matter is entirely clear. Nonetheless, as you are aware, and despite the fact that legislatures have enacted capital punishment all over the place, and that the great majority of the people, by all signs, are in favor of it, the judiciary has continued in one way or the other to frustrate both the intent of the Constitution and the will of the people. And that is by no means an exception. The same may be said, too, about generally speaking, to be true about generally speaking, the treatment of criminals, welfare payments, schooling, compulsory busing, and so on. In all of these matters, basically, the wishes of educational, welfare, and other bureaucracies have been followed, even when these wishes were very clearly contrary to the wishes of the majority of the voters. And they have been followed because the bureaucracy was able to enforce its views with the help of the judiciary bureaucracy, which is really not different from any other, of course. It is a group of non-elected, non-fireable people who do pretty much what they feel is in their interest, in the interest of the bureaucracy generally, or in the interest of whatever principles they regard as desirable. Now, we have retained the right to criticize and the right to vote. But the decision-making power has in effect shifted to the non-elected bureaucracy headed by judges. I don't know how permanent that shift is, and I'm unwilling to predict. I think it will be very hard to reverse it. So let me return then to the other avenue of limiting the power of bureaucracies, namely limiting the number and the scope of government activities. This too is endangered. The greatest limitation that in the last 200 years we have had on government authority occurred through the free market. People were free to produce what they felt they could sell, and people were free to buy what they wanted. People's income depended on how profitably they were able to sell what they produced. The government interfered relatively little in this. Well, you're all aware of the fact that government bureaucracies in a sense have never really been fully willing to accept that state of affairs, which is only about 200-300 years old. The system that preceded ours, called mercantilism by economic historians, was clearly a system where this, if it could be done at all, was done, so to speak, against the regulation of the economy then, rather than in conformity with it. And there seems little doubt that bureaucracies find it in their interest to return to what we may call a mercantilistic system, now called central planning or socialism. There are many reasons for which that appeals to many people. The automatic decision mechanisms of the market are invisible. It is in the nature of an automatic decision that it is invisible in the sense that you do not see a decision-making authority, since the decision is made by automatic forces. Intellectuals certainly have been able to persuade people and themselves that the absence of a directive authority equals the absence of direction, simply denying that there could be such a thing as an automatic direction. Hence, central planning appeals because it would have a visible directive authority, which, according to the central planners, would better be able to fulfill people's needs than people do whose interest is mainly in making a profit. Of course, central planners forget to add that people can only make a profit if they fulfill other people's wishes or needs. Actually, the purpose of central planning is to defeat the wishes of consumers, the wishes that consumers are able to gratify on the market, so as to gratify the preferences of the planners, which they will then attribute to people as their true needs, which owing to false consciousness or other things, people don't feel that they're able to realize. There is no other purpose in replacing the automatic controls and decision mechanisms of the market by manual controls manned by planners or bureaucrats. For what else are these planners if they are not bureaucrats? This indeed seems to me is the essence of socialism. Bureaucracy is the alternative to the market. It would decide how resources are allocated, what is to be produced, and by what methods. It would also decide who is to be rewarded. Now, the nature of the rewards under a socialist or planning system or whatever you wish to call it would remain quite the same as it is now. There are only three things with which people can be socially rewarded, and these are power, prestige, and money. Whether the system is capitalist or socialist, people will be promoted if they do well by the criteria of the system, and promotion will consist in additions to power, prestige, and income. So the motive of reward seekers will be quite the same, whether you call it profit motive or anything else. The rewards will be quite the same. But the rewards in a market system are given basically for what we may call economic merit, and they're given automatically. Those who succeed in making a profit have rewarded themselves, so to speak. The rewards in a central planning system or any totally bureaucratized system, and that is really what a socialism would amount to, or central planning, are given not for economic merit but for political merit, for the very simple reason that the decisions are no longer made automatically by the market according to economic criteria, but are made, as I put it, manually, that is, by persons rather than impersonal forces. And these persons will reward those who have been or will be politically useful in getting them to increase their power, prestige, or income, or maintain it. Hence, we will have a system in which the same rewards are given as are given today, simply because no others are really available, but they are given no longer automatically and no longer to those who have been able to produce profitably what people want, that is, to use less costly resources in their input than they produced in their output. But the rewards will go and to satisfy the wishes of consumers. But the rewards will be given to those who help in the production and distribution of political power, which, of course, almost by definition, makes a wholly bureaucratized system less efficient than a market system. If that is so, the question arises, first, what can be done about it? And second, I'll turn to that in a moment, why do people favor this bureaucratization? As to the first, I agree with my sometimes friend, Gordon Tullock, namely, that what we have to do is to try as well as we can to deprive the government of all functions that can be privately performed or can be not performed at all. We can do that by permitting competing agencies and companies. We can do that by selling government activities and so on. To just give an instance what I have in mind, Many people have figured out that in New York City, the garbage collection costs about double as much per ton collected than it would cost if it were privately collected. If he were simply to sell the garbage department to the highest bidder, it would cost about half as much. There's not the slightest chance at this point that we will do it. For a variety of reasons that I think you have already heard enough about today, so I will not repeat them. But I do not think we should be altogether discouraged. Such things can happen, and I think we should favor doing it. And as a matter of fact, there is almost a tendency in the government departments to make it happen. Look, for instance, at the garbage department in New York. It does so badly, leaving the streets so dirty, that it may, in time, produce enough public opinion to let it be done privately. People may not understand immediately that it costs less, but they may understand that where it is done privately, the streets are clean. So there is this possibility. As much as that can be done, I think we should favor doing it. Now let me turn to the next question that I mentioned, namely, why do so many people favor this total bureaucratization that I have called socialism? Now here the answer is psychological rather than economic. An economic system with a free market tends to reward economic merit. People do not feel that that is conforming to their sense of moral justice. They feel that the market system leads to morally unjust effects. As a matter of fact, I think they are right. It depends a little bit, of course, on how you wish to define moral justice. If you are a follower of Ayn Rand, or for that matter, John Bates Clark, you will simply define what I've called economic merit as equal to moral merit. That is, however, not as people feel, and I can't think of any moral philosopher except Robert Nozick now who would accept that sort of definition, and I think Nozick is simply wrong. That he attributes his error to nature doesn't make things any better. I'm not on very intimate terms with nature, and nature never told me that what Nozick heard from nature's mouth is true. If you don't accept this sort of thing, then I think you will come to the common sense idea of justice, which feels that it is unjust that, say, a man who was lucky in discovering an oil well, or who happens to be a very good manager, or who happens to have made a lucky real estate deal, or for that matter, an efficient one, should be rewarded much more highly than, say, a great poet, or philosopher, or a needy child, that, say, a faithful nurse should get so much less than, say, actress with a great deal of sex appeal, or something like that. Clearly, these are not what we regard, this is not what we regard as a distribution according to moral justice. Now, I think there's good economic justification for it. But what it basically means is that what is economically efficient, or economically rational, or economically deserved, does not coincide with what we feel is morally deserved and morally just. Specifically, the intellectuals have always felt that the distribution that the market generates is unjust because it doesn't reward them very well. It does not reward well their moral virtue as they see it, rightly and wrongly. Hence, intellectuals in particular have always seized on a more or less utopian bureaucratic system which they think will finally reward their moral virtue as it should be rewarded without compelling them to render demeaning economic services. Now, the intellectuals that we may, for the sake of discussion, want to call two intellectuals The inventors and analysts of new ideas are really not likely to do very well in a bureaucracy. They fantasy that they will, but experience shows that the persons who do likely to do well in a bureaucracy are clerks, people who lack any sort of originality and instead have the ability of manipulating bureaucratic power. There's no reason that that should be different in a fully bureaucratized system than it is in a halfway bureaucratized system such as we have now. Hence, in effect, the intellectuals will be very disappointed. And this disappointment you can see the beginnings of, for instance, now in Russia, where you have a significant group of intellectuals finally opposing the system either in part or fully. But this is something that intellectuals have to learn from experience. They don't learn it without experience, it seems. And of course, once they have the experience, it may be a little late, as it is in Russia. Secondly, the main group of intellectuals, whom we may call intellectuals by position, that is, people who diffuse, distribute ideas rather than either create or originally analyze them, the main group of intellectuals probably will do fairly well in a bureaucratized system, and hence they're not wholly wrong from their own viewpoint in advocating such a system. Although even that system still will not reward them for even their minor intellectual capacities, because as I said, it tends to reward basically the ability to produce and distribute political power in such a way as that the superiors benefit. Let me point out that the bureaucratized system, precisely because it tends to exclude more than the market system does, the actually original intellectuals will also be particularly inefficient, because it is almost, I'm tempted to say, in the nature of a bureaucracy that it tends to refuse that which is new, either as a product or as an idea or as a method of production, and that it tends to have great difficulties. In fact, an unwillingness to phase out what is old and obsolete and inefficient. Bureaucratic systems, in our experience, have always been static systems. Now, that is one of the attractions for people. They give the promise of stability, predictability, and so on. But when they embrace too many activities, that is also a reason for stagnation, which may lead to their ultimate downfall. But at any rate, as long as they exist, the rate of progress is likely to be greatly diminished. Still, they appeal, and I will now turn to another reason for appeal, namely, they help people in their flight from choice. When you are part of a bureaucratic system, and we have experienced that empirically with people who have fled from the Soviet Union, and certainly fled because they felt maltreated and not properly rewarded and so on, nonetheless, when they arrive and are confronted with our system, they feel enormously insecure, enormously disturbed, upset, and anxious, simply because they are confronted with numerous choices. Now, choice and freedom are the same thing. But choices, nonetheless, to most people, are psychologically uncomfortable. It means to have to grasp and understand and decide, and you cannot simply, with more or less grumblingly, accept the decisions that have been made for you. It means that you have to become, in some sense, an autonomous individual and so on, all of which I think is a burden on people, a burden that I think people should indeed learn to carry. But nonetheless, that is felt as a burden about which we have always, to say the least, felt quite ambivalent. And this is one of the attractions of a fully planned, fully bureaucratized system. Let me point out that to be part of a system presided over by a presiding authority for an announced purpose makes that system in some sense morally intelligible. to be part of a system that, as it were, runs by itself, automatically and by impersonal forces, such as the market, is hard to understand and, in a sense, psychologically desolating. This is one reason why people have never been willing to accept the belief, at least, that nature runs itself, and have always wanted to prefer belief that there's someone presiding over it for a purpose, and so on, even though that purpose be inscrutable and hard for us to understand. But the idea that it may be altogether automatic, as it were, has always been very hard to accept. I'm not discussing whether this idea is true or untrue, I'm discussing its psychological sources. The same is true for the market. It is hard to accept that it runs by itself. It is hard to accept that it actually could be highly organized and purposeful if there is no centrally visible authority. And because it is hard to accept, the alternative, which offers a central authority that is visible and that tells us that it does all these things to satisfy our needs of which we are not fully aware, and to gratify what we really want, and so on, that seems to some extent to be more acceptable, wherefore it has a great appeal, particularly, of course, to those who feel within the market system insufficiently rewarded. And these include, as I said before, largely the intellectuals, also to some extent the poor. About the poor, I just want to say, in passing, very little. They have become far fewer than they ever were there. The present poverty line, as you know, is $5,500 for a family of four. If you, with the appropriate corrections, project that back, you will find that in 1920, the equivalent purchasing power was had only by about 50% of the population. Now, between 11 and 13% have only $5,500 worth of purchasing power or less. So the number of poor has greatly decreased. Further, if you analyze the figures more, you will also find that the distance of the poor from the non-poor has greatly decreased. But you will also find, or should find, I think, that the resentment of the poor has increased. One simple reason that it has increased is precisely because there are fewer. 50% of the population are in a given situation. They understand that as natural, as acceptable, as in the, so to speak, in the nature of the world and society. When only 10 to 13% are, they feel passed by, they feel deprived, they feel resentful. And their resentfulness finds its echo among the non-poor, who feel guilty about having passed them by. I want to make it clear, I mentioned at the beginning, that bureaucracies are unavoidable, that the government bureaucracy is not the only bureaucracy. But what I perhaps should have stressed and want to stress now is that the government bureaucracy can become a monopoly bureaucracy. Sure, General Motors is an enormous bureaucracy, but the shareholder can always opt out. He can simply sell his shares. And since General Motors does know that, and since ultimately that knowledge is transformed into orders to the bureaucracy and so on, it tends to behave in such a way that shareholders will opt in rather than out. Furthermore, it has to sell, to achieve that, it has to sell its products and so on. So there are constraints on the private bureaucracy, which a government bureaucracy, which usually becomes a monopoly, lacks. I had no, would have no objection to a government bureaucracy subjected to the same constraints, namely if it were simply to compete with private bureaucracies. That is, if the government wanted to try to produce more automobiles in competition with General Motors. I may say it's an unwise decision, but the unwiseness of the decision will soon become so apparent that it wouldn't worry me at all. But if the government wants to say General Motors must stop producing automobiles and we produce them, then we are in real trouble. And that is, of course, what the government is saying in most activities. What remains, to me at least, one last question in this very sketchy exposition. The market system, the least bureaucratic of the available systems, is the most successful economic system that we have ever known in history, and it is at the present time more successful than any of the available alternatives anywhere else. Not only are the rich much richer than they used to be, but the poor are much richer than they used to be, and as I just pointed out, there are far fewer of them. Why then is the resentment of the market system and the hostility to it, the headlong flight into the arms of the bureaucracy, as strong as it is? Here I would just make a very brief historical excursion by drawing to your attention that the market system was protected against the cry, aperite mi portas justitiae, open to me the gates of justice, in the past by strongly held and widely diffused religious beliefs. In the first place, these religious beliefs did not confuse justice and equality or reduce one to the other. What greater inequality can there be than that between heaven and hell? And that is what we were promised in the life to come. Not equality, but the most pronounced and permanent of inequalities. But secondly, what religion did was to say, not that the distribution of the good things of this world was just in the market or in any other system, but rather that the injustice from a moral viewpoint of any system existing in any society was unalterable, and that perfect justice could be promised only in the life to come. That in the life to come, the injustice that were unavoidable in the market system and in any other system would be offset by appropriate compensation. Now, if you feel morally entitled to something, but see that your neighbor, the wicked prosper, gets what you feel is morally ought to be yours, that he discovered the oil well, and that you are hungry or needy or capable only of great things which nonetheless are, for one reason or other, not monetizable. If you have a religious belief that sooner or later your moral superiority in the life to come will be recognized, you will be patient with the system that fails to recognize it. However, it is in the nature almost of the market system to erode religious beliefs. One reason is in its diffusion of rationality, understood as rationalism, as an insistence on testability here and now, on reward here and now, and as a loss of faith in that which was not tangible, but was promised only for the future. And secondly, the market system, of course, is in the nature of the matter, making it very hard, I would say impossible, to continue or respect traditions. But now, inequalities, when they are sanctified as it were, habituated to by tradition, tend to be tolerated. Inequalities that constantly change in their distribution are very hard to tolerate, and are very hard to regard as in the nature of things. If it happened to him, why shouldn't it happen to me? Yet it is in the nature, of course, as I needn't explain to you, of a market system, that precisely because it is rational, it distributes rewards differently from in every generation. And let me point out here that such interesting phrases as equality of opportunity and so on do not meet this problem of felt injustice. It is precisely because equality of inequality will increase the inequality of results that it is, if anything, more resented than inequality of opportunity sanctified by tradition ever was. It is true that if we do tolerate some things which are based on equality of opportunity, provided they are relatively marginal, if not trivial. For instance, people seldom envy the benefits and rewards that sports heroes get. They have equal opportunity, and one becomes a great football or baseball hero, and so on the basis of his natural equipment and whatnot. Well, that is usually not greatly envied, or it usually does not disturb people greatly, because it is tangible and visible wherein his superiority does consist, as it is not with a banker, say, or a businessman. Or when the rules of distribution have total equality of opportunity, yet the distribution is very unequal, and it can be clearly attributed to luck, again, it is not greatly resented. A lottery gives all purchasers of a ticket exactly the same opportunity and then distributes as unequally as can be. People do not usually envy the winner greatly or feel that there's a great injustice done. But these are marginal activities. When it comes to more central activities that direct, as it were, our life as a whole, people do not wish. They regard it as inconsistent with moral justice to be subject to chance, as they are willing to be with respect to a lottery or with respect to achievement in sports, which after all depend on whether chance made you have the right kind of parents and so on, with the right kinds of inheritance and whatnot. People do want what they regard as moral justice. This moral justice is a chimera. It doesn't really consist of equality, though people may confuse it with equality. If we had total equality, I'm not discussing that for various reasons this is inconceivable, in the first place, people would still resent each other's superiority or inferiority in a variety of ways. One girl is prettier than another, one girl is more successful than another, and so on and so on, and people would, of course, resent that, as they now may resent other things. Secondly, if you abstract from that, if you had total equality, it would mean that the indolent or stupid worker would have to be paid the same as the non-indolent or non-stupid worker, and people would resent that too. But meanwhile, they resent it the other way. So what I'm trying to say is that the idea of moral justice is something that is very profoundly felt by people. But at the same time, it is really a chimera if you are attempting to define it. Nonetheless, this chimera is very powerful in people's mind and leads them to prefer a wholly bureaucratized system in many cases to one which they feel, in which they feel their rewards depend on either economic desert or luck or both. They will prefer a system where some sort of general parental authority promises to reward them according to their moral abilities and virtues. The promise will not be fulfilled, but the promise is very powerful. Thank you.
Instead of responding officially to Professor Van Tank, will try to do so seriatim, piecemeal, as members of the audience introduce questions. I think some of you are already eager to put forward a response. I see already a hand and noticed it, Steve. And I will reserve one or two small comments, which are not really in dispute, but in supplement, until the occasion presents itself. Now, the first hand that I saw here was that of Professor Pavich. Did you have something in particular? Okay. All right. All this put me in mind, I will say this at this point, that it put me in mind of my recent reading of Michael Oakeshott and of his discussion of the difference between the teleocratic and the nomocratic state. The state is an enterprise association which comes together to achieve some purpose that is formulated extrinsically, and the state that comes into being, if you like, historically, and which is cemented by usage and habit, custom, and by existential facts which people who live in the state don't have to think about, and which whose rules and orders are negotiated in the course of its existence. And I think that one kind of enterprise association state allows for, on the one hand, an appeal to the merits of the free market, and on the other hand, to the gradual evolution of a bureaucratic and planned economy. And I think recent American history is an illustration of this kind of melange. Now, it's logically, philosophically inconsistent. It's made possible by the death rattle of the myth of progress, which, though dying, dies very hard. And the intellectual confusion behind it, as it exists in the population at large, is probably incurable for some of the reasons Professor Vandenhagen has detailed. I do, however, submit that among the instruments, the political instruments, for defanging the monster of egalitarian ideology and thus cornering and dispensing with the services of bureaucrats is to establish, this is the rhetorician speaking again, to establish the dilemma in the minds of the same populace that is perfectly willing to see Willie Mays paid $150,000 whether or not they like black people because he's graceful and chasing fly balls. I think that the same kind of dilemma can be, must be, really, unless we are to be stuck with the slow growth of Leviathan, by presenting an alternative which is more unattractive to them than the injustice under which they unreasonably believe themselves to chafe. And I think that this, on occasion, may require more of us than just honest philosophical analysis of the sort that we've enjoyed just now, but also a leisure domain equivalent to that which brought us to this pass. That is to say, our own kind of myth-making. And it's not a myth-making that's as illegitimate as the kind we're contending with. We have to conjure up pictures in the minds of the electorate, since we live within a representative society, if not a democracy, I hope not quite a democracy. We have to conjure up pictures of where all this leads. And we have to, I think, monolithically focus our energies, our political energies, if not our analytic energies, on formulating the most monstrous image of this bugbear, which is not really just a bugbear, but may indeed turn out to be the monster of our nightmares. And we have to be willing, at least for the purposes of argument, to believe in it altogether ourselves. Professor Vandenhagen suggested something a little bit of the kind in talking about what sort of circumstances really hypothetically, not really, but hypothetically, allow us to imagine a society of equals, and how that society really wouldn't be a society of equals. A society where everyone, as we all agree, a society where everyone was totally regimented, which is also impossible. would be a society where there was one personality and one will. And to hammer at the prospect of such a society, and also to, as much as possible, paint the exercise of free choice as a very charming exercise, as something from which, even though risky, great pleasure derives, a pleasure, if not equivalent, at least in competition with money and power and status, or a pleasure which makes money and power and status altogether more pleasant. A pleasure which, if we won't say is in keeping with the nature of man, at least is in keeping with the record and conduct of man, as we've known him historically. A pleasure which is definitive of him as man, and without which he becomes something with which we don't really want to be identified. Now, I think the same fellow who is willing to see a ball player or an actress overpaid is willing to acknowledge, and I'll use the word advisedly, but I mean it seriously, that the kind of dignity that's attached to free choice and to a life that allows a reasonable scope for free choice is something that the same fellow who is eaten up with envy and who feels, because he is beneath the poverty line slightly, feels that he has been somehow or another deprived, feels a sense of injured merit, will also define what he wants as including not merely money and power and status, but also the opportunity to implement that his own sense of merit in some way that involves free choice. Now, these are very sketchy remarks and very general, and their nature is to some extent dictated by the paradigm Professor Vandenhagen has established here. But I would like to hear some response to that also. How do we how do we extricate ourselves from the tentacles of the ever-growing state? How do we get the electorate to sense any kind of imperative of the sort that we here gathered think on all the time? It's a puzzle to me. I propose the use of the rhetorical dilemma, the painting of an alternative image, even more unattractive than injustice, as being, in terms of politics, at least a necessary beginning. I have at this point, no substantive theoretical dispute with what Professor Vandenhagen said.
Yes, you do.
Well, I'll reserve it then.
No, you haven't. You have totally misunderstood what I said.
So,
I certainly do not fear that actresses or ball players are overpaid.
No, I didn't imply that you did.
You suggested as much.
No.
I think they're paid their market value. And my point was that market value and moral merit are not the same. I do not think that we have an alternative here to propose. I think, I'll leave that for later. But let me put it this way: I do not think that that there is a question of overpayment or a question of some more just system that we could figure out.
No, that wasn't my point.
Well, then let me get
clear. Steve.
Yes, I hope I. I hope I misunderstood, because otherwise I will have to say that you might be a fool.
I'm sorry.
And of course, anyone who disagrees with Gordon Tullock has to be wrong.
That's an illustration of the kind of false dilemma I was
saying. I have one statement and one question to ask you. You said, I believe, that the free market tends to erode religious beliefs. Well, there is nothing in the logic of the free market that would suggest how and why our values will change. I think you are wrong that the free market does not change my values. It simply makes me free to reveal my values. And therefore, people are freer to do what they please. And therefore, it may appear that they are less religious. But at the same time, they are as unreligious or religious as they would have been on the other side. The market does not change my policy. Thank you, free to review. That's the first comment. And the second is on the question of moral justice.
Let me answer the first, because my memory is short. You don't have a second. In a second, I just want to answer this one very briefly. First, I never disagree with Gordon Tullock. It is true that he sometimes disagrees with me, but we will not take that seriously. Second, you misunderstood, or I was not sufficiently clear. It is not that the logic of the free market, as you put it, erodes religious beliefs. It is merely that it creates a psychology that does. There's nothing logically inherent in the free market that prevents you from holding any religious beliefs that you wish. There is, however, something in the psychological development that it sets in motion, which leads people to discount the world to come in favor of this world. They will have religious beliefs satisfied with ideologies referring to this world. That's a different matter. But the emphasis on salvation to come definitely has decreased since, say, about the 18th century. And that is, I think, as the Marxists would say, no accident. It has decreased both with religious people and with not religious people. If you look at the behavior of organized religion, you will find that its emphasis has more and more veered on adjusting what it feels to be injustices in this world. And if you look at the behavior of non-religious people, that is even more true. That is the belief in a reward to come in the world to come and a punishment to come, particularly the belief in a punishment to come, has almost totally disappeared from people's consciousness. Now, you may relate this to things extraneous to the free market, but I think there is a great deal to be said that would indicate that the free markets, the rise of science, all kinds of other things, none of which makes this logically necessary, have nonetheless created the psychology that made that possible. And that's all I've said.
Professor Klevitch, you
believe that the freedom for us to behave the way we always wanted to behave, and we couldn't.
Well, I don't know. There's no way in which you could test that proposition.
No, in that case, it's statement 70.
Steve, what was your other
question? That is what I was politely implying.
Steve, what was your other question?
My other question was in respect to the term moral justice. I kept asking my friends, philosophy and other fields, they always use the term, and you're the person I think I should ask, because I know I can get answered. As I talk to people, they have different definitions. Different people define justice differently. And if there is no consensus on what justice is,
I think your question is, to be honest, rather than polite, a little naive. You see, I am not saying that there is a moral justice, a system that I or somebody else has worked out and that we only need to apply. On the contrary, I said it's a chimera. There is no such system, and there is, for various reasons, no such system possible. I am referring to a psychological need. People feel that it is morally unjust that the actress gets more than the nurse, that the discoverer of the oil well lives comfortably, whereas the needy child is not living comfortably, and so on and so on. I'm not saying that people have constructed a system that would tell them just how things are to be distributed or so. In fact, for various reasons, I do not believe there is a possibility of constructing such a system. People such as Rawls, say, basing himself on the work of economists, and economists, many economists, have tried to figure out what they call a social welfare function and various other things. In my opinion, all this has led to absolutely nothing. It's quite an interesting intellectual exercise. But there is no such thing, and there is no such thing as moral justice. But you see, the trouble with you, Steve, is that you are an economist. You think logically, which is fine, but is not a good description about people's feelings.
And people are run to a large extent, not exclusively, but they're run to a large extent by feelings, and there is a feeling about moral justice. Which feeling is very vague in its outlines, but it excludes certain things. If you ask people in a poll, would they regard it as right the way things are now distributed, the answer would be no. Now, they may not be able to figure out exactly how, and moreover, if they figured it out, it would not be possible because of incentives and various other things, but that is not the point I'm making. The point I'm making is that people attribute the difficulties that are probably difficulties of reality in general to a particular system and long for an alternative. Now, as I have pointed out, the alternative for various reasons will be worse. But that is something that they have not experienced. So their hostility to the present system is based on the feeling that it does not do what they feel to be moral justice.
I would, I'm about to acknowledge Professor Hutt's question here, but just to suggest one other thing in relationship to this line of questioning. It's always puzzled me how that, and I accept Professor Van Hague's general description of the effect of the free market, the operation of the free market on religious value systems in the West. And yet central to that, the free market theory, is the mystery, the central mystery of how all of these free agents acting out their own will without coercion somehow or another is conducive to the general good of society.
That's not somehow or another. That's yes, the way that this system works, and it's yes, very easily explained. There's no mystery.
It is also a perceivable mystery.
Now, people don't feel that. Right.
Yes. But whatever, we're talking about experience here, though not about economic theory. And the experience of that mystery is suggestive. I'll avoid a general term here, but it is suggestive of something constituent in the nature of things that would seem to me more conducive to religious feeling than to irreligious feeling.
I must say I disagree with you as fully as I can.
Okay. It obviously has not. I agree with you that it has not. It's worked to the contrary. Professor Hutt has a question.
Mr. Chairman, one or two points occurred to me, related points, in respect of the fundamental things that that Dr. Van Hague has been dealing with. Now, I see things from the Austrian viewpoint, or particularly the Hayekian viewpoint, and the first concerns the phrase which Dr. Van Hague quoted, which is constantly used, of course, the objection to a system which runs itself. The word runs itself, according to Dr. Mendhart. The viewpoint of the Austrian is exactly the opposite, that if governments act, the notion that they act purposefully and deliberately and so forth reverses the truth. Because when governed particularly, they act without knowledge of the facts which are relevant to whatever decision they make. Whereas when what we call the market is acting, the people who actually make the decisions, the board of directors, making up its mind whether or not to erect another factory with machinery sunk into concrete, which is non-versatile machinery, and where they have to forecast that there's going to be sufficient supplies of materials and labor, and there's going to be sufficient demand for what they turn out in the future. They make that decision in the light of all sorts of imponderables, risk-taking therefore, but that decision is a responsible decision because they are in a position to know the facts. And there are millions of these different decisions constantly being made by people who are in contact with the factors, whereas governments cannot, knowledge cannot be fruitfully and realistically focused. And that is the point. But it goes further than this. The market as itself, in itself, is as neutral as a computer, and very much like a computer. The market is simply a system under which all human objectives, the objective of a product and the marketing of the product, can be